Just keep those love offerings coming in and keep us on the air.
Well, as I said earlier, my name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic, and you know that. And I'm back to harass you a little bit about the traditions. The steps are, I was thinking a little earlier, I hadn't really thought of it this way. But you know, there's a school of thought of which I am a member, which feels the book to be at least somewhat divinely inspired. As I've often said over the years, in my opinion, Bill Wilson did not know enough to write the book when he was 3 years sober. When people have been working on the problem of alcoholism for 4,000 years, and here's a guy with 3 years of sobriety, most of which surrounded by failure. Most of the people were failures. That first 100, most of them died drunk. You know, it's surrounded by failures. And wrote a book based on limited observation of people, most of whom were failures. And wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 53 years than all other therapies combined in the last 4,000 years. It indicates some sort of a miraculous something. It may be a series of fortuitous inspirations, but in my opinion, I like to think it was something, some power greater than ourselves was guiding his hand from time to time. Although you see influences. If you ever read that book that they showed us last night, The Common Sense of Drinking, you see some of the big book was taken from that. And some of the big book's ideas were taken from The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James, and so on. But even if you could, to go to the ultimate extreme and say, well, it's all just taken from somewhere, it was put together in a form that was never put together before, and it worked. And these 12 steps were certainly a part of that. You know, in passing, I've said this before, but I might as well say it again because I'd like to hear it. And that is that to this young man who introduced me, Bob, when you hear that the book was written by someone 3 years sober, and he's a year sober, I'm sure the thought has come, well, it's easy for him to write a book. He's 3 years sober, for God's sakes. But you will discover, Bob, when you get to be 3 years sober, you don't know enough to write a book. And by the time you get to be 5 years sober, you really just kind of patronize people who are 3 years sober. Still going to meetings, Jimmy? Keep it up. And by the time you're 10 years sober, as I often say, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee, because they get, was that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one? Oh, never mind. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. And yet this person 3 years sober has written a book that has changed the course of human experience. Now, I would say that the 12 steps, as we read, when you read about how they happen to be, much of course based primarily on the Oxford Six Steps, but Bill didn't feel the Oxford Six Steps quite communicated the way, and there were some other things he felt he should add. And we remember reading, or I'm sure you've read somewhere or have heard, that he was just baffled in writing this stage of the book, and he just was, what the hell am I going to, what? He was lying down one night and suddenly in his house, and suddenly struck me, that's what it should be. And he jumped up and in 3 minutes wrote the 12 steps. Just like that. Just had an inspiration of some sort. It fell in place. Now, the reason I say that is because 12 and 12 talks about a lot of reasons and a lot of insights into the 12 steps. But like most decisions in the world, they are reasons written after the fact. In other words, the inspiration was there, then you fill in the reasons for it. He didn't lie there and suddenly, page after page of the 12 and 12 came to him. Yeah. The 12 steps, as we see them here, as he wrote, were written to describe a spiritual feeling that he got and a spiritual impetus of some sort. So the 12 steps and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous were all written in a spiritual context. And as we talked about a little bit last night, the traditions are opposite. The traditions are something written years later with a pragmatic experience reason. The book was not written based on experience, really, or the 12 steps weren't based on experience. You couldn't say these people are taking the 12 steps. There weren't any 12 steps to take. In fact, as you'll remember, when the book came out, Bill had written the steps as far as he could tell about how it came to him. And after the book came out, there was a big upset in the fellowship because they went to Bill and said, "That's wrong. You have in the 12th step, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. If you ever see your first edition, that's what it says." And they said, "We didn't have any spiritual experience. You had a spiritual experience. And you had it in Towns Hospital long before you ever had AA. So what the hell is this?" And he said, "That's right." And it was mentioned again earlier, the book sold so slowly they had a lot of time to think about it. And I suppose it's safe to say they, little by little, they came upon the at least a hint, or they came upon the odor of something. And that was that, what was it? Dr. Jung said you had to have a spiritual experience. Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience, and he was sober. But here are these other people sober, and they didn't have a spiritual experience. Was Dr. Jung wrong? What is it? And I think, in retrospect, we can see today that I firmly believe that Dr. Jung was absolutely right in what he said, and this always will be. But how could this be if we haven't had a spiritual experience? But they begin to see little by little that in some strange way no one can explain or define, and can't to this day, that the 12 steps do something that nothing has ever done in the history of the treatment of alcoholism. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience, little by little, not the way Bill Wilson got his, boom! But the way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch. And on and on and on. Now, I don't think they fully appreciated that in 1939 or 1940. But they understood a little hint of it, so that the time the next edition came out, they changed the 12th step, the only steps that have ever been changed. And they changed it to read, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which has always been that way ever since. But this brought about this spiritual incremental spiritual experience. And still, as we talked about last night, by the early 1940s, AA was shaking apart like a Model T with a Chrysler engine. It had a lot of potential there, but there was nothing to hold it in. So Bill Wilson, following the examples that he had seen, this guy writing him about the Oxford, about the Washingtonians, and his endless phone calls and letters he wrote, as we talked about, "Guy, what do we do about this?" He never told anybody what to do. He just always said, "Here's what somebody tried," or "Let us know what you're going to do." And so, the traditions were first printed in 1946. And they really have held up well. They're rather moot now, many of them, because they're just accepted. Some of them are under assault. Different ones get under different assault. It's fun to remember sometimes that even these rather simple things, the traditions, almost caused terrible splits in AA, because AA was full of alcoholics then too. And we're not going to take any of your laws, rules. We came here for spiritual freedom. And there was a great deal of opposition to the 12 traditions. Great deal of opposition. They're big. And as you know, as I mentioned last night, AA, we like to think of those early pioneers like we think of the early Christians, just wonderful people living in the catacombs, all working together. Yes, feed me to the lions, I don't care. Not quite. There's a lot of problems, and you know, for example, you know, I was thinking about this here. Then we had that first wonderful convention in Cleveland. That almost didn't come off at all because there were such divisions in AA. There was the New York segment and the Midwest segment. But I really feel the other way around, but I want to alienate you if I can. The Midwest segment were heavily into the four absolutes and Oxford stuff. But anyway, there were the Dr. Bob followers, which included many of the people, as I said last night, that Hank Pankhurst had traveled around and denounced Bill Wilson to these people, so they were joined the Dr. Bob followers. And there was the Bill Wilson followers in New York. And Bill and Dr. Bob got along well, but they thought it'd be good if they could get everybody together, maybe, because as Richard so well described last night, the unity has always been a problem in AA. But always, if we work at it 100% of the time from now on, we may get it 2% of the time. That's really, it's a bunch of self-will run riot pukes are what we are. I agree with you if you say it my way. If you don't, get out. Start your own group, son of a bitch. You know, I love to read these books too. They talk about deep spiritual things, like we're hearing Willie this morning and hearing John. It's just, it flows so wonderfully. But we something about it. Very few of us are able to remember that on a day-to-day basis. You know, it's like I used to say, you know, I used to get great spiritual experiences and they'd last till the first lady cut me off on the freeway, you know. I'm in a kind of a pragmatic. I have not as progressed as some, I guess, what AA has been able to teach me or laboriously over the years is that I, when someone cuts me off or hurts me on the freeway, I don't have to chase them past my exit. Yeah, I'll tell you. If I haven't caught them by 4th Street in downtown Los Angeles, I... We'll meet again, Red Baron. Because other people seem to have great made achievements that are far beyond me. They've given up anger, rage, crossness, and I guess I'm doomed to always live just 2 sandwiches short of a picnic. You know, just people sometimes say to me, "It's so sad you've been sober for 33 years, almost 34 years, and you don't always walk the way you talk." And I think that's absolutely true, but you can be glad I don't walk the way I think. Yeah, that's but the they almost didn't have this convention, I started to say, and the people in Akron said, "We don't mind having a convention, but we're not going to New York." And the people in New York said, "Well, we don't mind having a convention, but we're not going to Akron." Listen to the four absolutes. So they almost came apart. Bill and Dr. Bob finally got together and came up with a Solomon-like decision. Cleveland. Okay. And away they went to Cleveland. And it's an interesting thing, of course, at Cleveland, most of you know, that's where Dr. Bob gave his last talk. Most of us have read it or heard it on tape. Dying of cancer, carried to the podium. And he, little by little, talked about this things, keep it simple and leave the scientific things of value to scientists, to the scientists. And Let's never be too busy to stop and give the man behind us a pat on the back, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. And it really is a touching and beautiful little talk. But another aspect of that convention some people don't realize. I have the tapes home of that convention. And one of the highlights of that convention is they took 12 men, one after another, and they got up, and each of them tried to explain one tradition so the people wouldn't resent and hate them. Much of that convention was devoted to trying to educate people of the traditions, that they were not threatening things. Because it was tearing apart somebody. They read things into them. And one by one, these guys get up and explain, it isn't threatening. This is what it means, and this is why it means it. Obviously, they got the information from Bill, I suppose. And at the end of that convention, they voted to accept the 12 traditions. That's when they were accepted. Before that, it was just Bill's mind into the grapevine. And now, as we talked about last night, the fifth tradition, a big tradition, probably the one most under assault in the world today. Why do we have to be an alcoholic? We certainly discussed that ad infinitum last evening. And this morning we're going to discuss three other traditions. None of these are really under great assault. One is, but one is not much to discuss. I could open the book and read them to you, but it's the spirit of them that we have to remember, not the words on page 84. Now the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. No big deal there, you know. But in a sense, it's a funny thing how this has changed. Now, most of us have read in the history, you can read in your 12 and 12, how that came about. Because there were people setting up all sorts of rules. They wanted to keep out the riffraff out of AA, the crazy people, the goofs, people like you and me, really. It's a funny thing. AA is very similar to America, I think. People get here on low immigration, and as soon as they get here, they want to raise the immigration to keep fools like me out. In those days, it wouldn't be that way now, but in those days, they were worrying about crazy people and so on, and we all know that fabled story that's that all this rules and 61 rules, and someone says don't take yourself so damn seriously, and there are all kinds of rules of women. Women could not be in the first meetings in Los Angeles, 1939. There was a woman alcoholic named Sybil came, and she brought her non-alcoholic husband to the first, maybe the fifth meeting, and they wouldn't let her in the meeting. They let her husband come in, the non-alcoholic, because they didn't want any woman screwing it up, and certainly understand that. I don't mean now, I mean then. They had no way of... I have three daughters in AA, and I wouldn't want this reported back to them because they'd kill me. But it's really, it's funny though. Got to remember, the 12 traditions were originally written and presented in the long form. Now, the short form is just kind of where it became an abbreviation. The long form really explains what they're about. Most of you should have it in your book. Where I live, my home group, I guess it's the biggest group in the world, maybe 1,200 people every Wednesday night, up and exciting, and tapes go all over the world. Some of you, a number of people in this room, get those tapes every week. We read the long form of the traditions once a month. And they say, it takes 3 minutes to read. That's right. And it may save you 30 years of your life. But it's the long form of the traditions. And I'm surprised how many meetings in the country don't read the traditions at all, even the short form. If they do read them, they usually just give it to some newcomer to see if he can pronounce autonomous, you know. There. You read them, Jimmy. Each group should be anatomical. But we got to take these things seriously, people who know better. I presume you know better or you wouldn't be here. One of the great problems of this sort of a meeting, unfortunately, is that the people who really need to know these things don't come to this sort of a meeting. We are preaching to the converted. But hopefully we can instill some desire for us all to go back and disseminate and not allow ourselves to just go with the flow because it's more convenient. But it's an odd thing. The third tradition, how it evolved in the long form, let me read the long form of the third tradition to you. It's quite simple. Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Nobody questions that today. That's been accepted for years and years. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. That is, none who are alcoholics. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Certainly true. We all know that. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group. Certainly we understand that. Provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. Now, in the last few years, that last phrase has become the one under attack. Oddly enough. It was, when he wrote it, it was just almost a throwaway line. But that has become the big thing today. Over the years, little by little, there have sprung up a proliferation of groups that have other affiliation. We call them special interest groups. The special interest groups are intellectually very wonderful, but emotionally they very rarely ever are effective. For a very simple reason. The number one problem in all alcoholics, I believe, is the deep-seated feelings of my case is different. When you get together with other people like you, you now reinforce that feelings of difference. When a doctor sits just with other alcoholic doctors, they can talk all night about how different it is to be a doctor, and all they hear is agreement. When lawyers sit with other lawyers, they talk about how different it is, our problems as a lawyer. Actors sit with actors. Airline pilots sit with airline pilots. And it's really wonderful. But their recovery ratio in these special interest rates groups are very low. Truly very low. I remember when I was new, first time I started to be aware of this, there was a very famous movie actor in Los Angeles who was an aide, had been an aide for 7 or 8 years. And he had a special movie actors meeting in his garage. What he would call a garage, we would call a small mansion. That's where the footman knocked around. But anyway. And it was by invitation only. And I was not a very savory looking character or feeling. I mean, I'm skinny, and between my occasional talks at Overeaters Anonymous. Didn't have any front teeth yet. But I'd learned to carry my lip like this. So a lot of people thought, didn't know I didn't have front teeth. They thought I'd been burned in the fire. And I wanted so much to get to that. I mean, you know, I pretend to be sophisticated, but I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and here's all them movie stars. And I sucked around people I'd just soon smash in the face. And I learned one thing in business, and I translated to AA. In business, I learned a little brown on the nose puts a little gold in the pocket. And I now translate this to AA. A little brown on the nose may get me to that damn meeting. And I simulate interest in the most boring, tedious pukes you ever saw. And I finally got the invitation. I was just sick with excitement, but I almost couldn't sleep the night before. And I went to this meeting, and there I sat in this garage, this lovely ornate garage, and upholstered seats, and around the room were stars I had seen, movies, and just wondering. Oh! I thought, what's a guy like me, 2 years old? These guys all been here 8, 10 years. And they went around and discussed the problems of being an actor in the movie business and how their feelings were such and their emotions were such and how they had to go through. And I just couldn't believe it. They got to me and I didn't hardly have anything to say. But on the way home, it suddenly struck me. I had the most sobriety in the room. My 2 years, and I told my sponsor about it, and he pointed that out to me. He said, those guys don't stay sober. All they do is explain to each other why they slip, and the rest of them understand it. And that really is true. That is the downfall of the special interest group. It reinforces your basic feeling of my case truly is different. Now, there's an organization called the International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous, of which, as a member of AA, I have no opinion. But I know several members. And although certain aspects of that organization feel they can come here and stay sober, very few do. The International Doctors in AA have a great function, in my opinion. It's a place for doctors to go and can feel anonymous, their anonymity is protected, they feel secure, they can feel safe, they're surrounded by people like them. But the successful IDAA meetings eventually say, now you've got your foot, now you've got to go out in the real world. You go sit in AA meetings because that's where the answer is. And now you have enough security to do it. And that's why we have, in fact, some of the great AA members of our group in the world are doctors. Same thing with the international lawyers in AA. They go there and they say, but I'm a lawyer. They say, well, come just with the other lawyers. We can discuss the problem of being a lawyer. And some people stay there because they never get any better. And they go down the toilet. But there are other ones, they say, you got to get out in the world now. And there's all kinds of lawyers in AA. God, I sponsor 5 lawyers. And they're a bad bunch. They keep looking for some place to appeal my decisions. Airline pilots. I'm very familiar with that organization called Birds of a Feather. And very good, because pilots have to be in this, you know. I sponsor a pilot, senior pilot, just retired from United Airlines, you know. And he tells his story. It's enough to send a shiver down your spine. He says, well, then we're coming to Logan Field that day, and I... We just had a half-hour break, Marlene. Wasn't that enough for you? Right. Bring a compact next time. You won't have to keep returning the mirror. Anyway, I don't want to get into personalities. I'm her sponsor. She's, for 25 years I've been putting up with that behavior, and it's making me crazy. If you think she's bad now, you should have seen her 25 years ago. But you're fine. Anyway. This guy's saying, well, then I was a little hungover that day, and I was a little sick, and I didn't know I was on call until they called me, and I, you know, landing in Logan, they're kind of a small airport, kind of tough trying to see that white line. Oh, shit. And they get in there, and but the ones that are successful go on to AA. And the same thing with musicians. All sorts of people think their case is different, and if they surround themselves by other people whose case is different, they can destroy themselves. That's one of the problems today. We sometimes have elitist AA. Invitation only AA. People who are specially better types of alcoholics. And that's fine for a little while, I guess. But it atrophies and turns into what my case truly is different type of things. And that's why they're bad. Not because there's anything inherently bad. Well, there's a few things that are inherently bad. But there's nothing inherently bad about, you know, in AA. No one can legislate who your friends are. Certainly you gravitate to people you know or like or, you know, from your home group. When you go to a convention, it's nice to have other people there from your home group. It would be a superhuman being who just kept trying to find new strangers and say, hi, 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 you know. Betty, are you over there? Because we're human beings. But we have to be very careful about that. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and that it isn't quite the same thing, but it is kind of the same thing. They're going to start a new group. They're going to make invitation only. They're going to have just better types of alcoholics, certain types of alcoholics. And they're going to do it this way so that they won't have the conflicts like they had at Midtown and other places. And there's nothing wrong with it. But I'll tell you one thing, you better change it pretty soon. Because otherwise you get in here that same incestuous self-cannibalization. And with the best of motives, with the best of intentions, has nothing to do with motives, it's something to do from years of experience. Because Alcoholics Anonymous crosses all lines, age, and background, and sex, and religion, and color, and all these things. AA should be a microcosm of the world you're going to meet out there. And as the, it's a terrible thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. In my opinion, if you can make it in AA, you can make it anywhere. Like that Frank Sinatra song, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. If you can make it in AA, you can make it anywhere, I'll tell you. That's not really true, but it seems that way sometimes. So that's why you have to be careful that you don't fall into little special interest groups. That AA as such must always be a microcosm of the society in which you live. That all who are welcome, who wish to come, we can turn none away, specifically says that. Okay, that's all there is in the third tradition to deal with. We don't have to worry that the alcoholics can get in, but we must remember that that also, in a sense, reinforces the fifth tradition. You must be here with the desire to stop drinking. You may also wish to stop other chemicals, but you must be here as an alcoholic to stop drinking. In fact, after these traditions were written, somewhere along the line, and nobody to this day can remember when, for years and years in AA, nobody ever got up and said, "My name is Fred and I'm an alcoholic." They just got up and started to talk. Somewhere in the dim recesses of the past, somebody began to say, "My name is Al, I'm an alcoholic." And nobody knows why. Nobody knows who did it. But it was, in a sense, a fact. Look, I'm here for drinking problems. And then little by little, it proliferated. Then in California, they start saying, "Hi." Now they say that all over. But it started off just people getting up, not even getting up, sitting at the table. "I used to drink terribly, and I came here, and I'm trying to do these things, and no names, no nothing." So, third tradition is really not much argument. Eighth tradition, there's not much. Let me say this. There are two forms of there are two types of traditions that we have in our traditions. One is the traditions based on the Washingtonian experience primarily. One based on the early AA experience. Fifth tradition is based on the Washingtonian experience. The third tradition is based on the early AA experience, where all these people were trying to keep people out because of one reason or another. The eighth tradition is also based on alcoholics' early AA experience. They didn't have much problem with this at the Washingtonians because there were no paid employees of the Washingtonians either, in the sense that they talk about here. And it says that we can never be paid for our 12-step work. And that's very simple. And in 1953, when he wrote this, there was a lot of heat on about getting paid for things. There was a lot of heat about affiliated organizations getting a ride on AA's coattails. Most of you remember how John mentioned the... showed a picture of a Marty Mann last night, said this was the first woman who stayed sober. There were other women in AA before her, but she was the one who stayed sober, and then she went on to form the National Council on Alcoholism, and they didn't have any way to go about this, and she had Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson on the letterhead to imply there was AA affiliation. I'll tell you how long that went on. That went on for years after that. As soon as there were some problems, Bill and Dr. Bob asked their name to be taken off. But everybody's operating the best of intentions. But when I was new in 1958 and 59, I remember there was a terrible to-do. I didn't understand it, but I remember it now, in Santa Barbara, because the local Council on Alcoholism was soliciting funds so they could help AA, educate people about AA. And there was a terrible schism. People got drunk over that and raised hell and all sorts of things. There's always been this thing about affiliation, but also getting paid. How can you get paid and be doing this kind of work? And it's, that has been resolved over the years very easily, over the years. It's been quite clear, and I don't think there's any question about it. In the early days, when people were all at each other's throats, no one really had a basis for it. But the 12 traditions explain it, and it's almost a moot point again. You know, we accept the fact that there are Alcoholics Anonymous members working in our World Service Office, because they are people who, we need people with their experience and knowledge to accept calls and take actions dealing with alcoholism. We cannot hire a non-alcoholic secretary to come in and deal with loners or to deal with group policies. It has to be an aim. And we can hire alcoholics in jobs where we would otherwise use non-alcoholics. There's nothing wrong with that. There are some questions about alcoholics working in treatment centers. And there's nothing really wrong with that unless they talked about themselves as being AAs or describe themselves as an AA. Some treatment centers, in their desperate urge to get business, say, we have AAs on our staff teaching Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes they list the names of the alcoholics on their staff, which is absolutely wrong. Because if they're teaching Alcoholics Anonymous, then they are getting paid for 12-step work. But they are able to, you know, it's the same thing. We talk about AA clubs. We hire janitors and managers for AA clubs. Well, there's only one thing wrong with that. There is no such a thing as an AA club. There are clubs in which AAs gather and maybe you support and run. But AA does not have clubs. AA does not have hospitals. One of the great breaks of all time, that the book sold so slowly they couldn't get the damn hospitals built. They'd hoped, one of the reasons for the book was to get money to build hospitals. And it sold slowly. God said no. Don't tell me what to do. But it really is quite understandable. We could flog that for half an hour, but it really is not necessary. It's quite understandable that we can hire people who would be doing jobs otherwise would go to non-alcoholics. We can have people work in our central offices. We need people in our central offices. The point is that we don't ever get paid for our 12-step work. When you are working with another alcoholic one-to-one, you never get recompensed for it, because it takes away from the spiritual concept of what you are doing. As I think it was Willie this morning mentioned, all of these steps are designed not to help the person I'm helping, but to help me. They are over a period of time to alter my perception of reality, to do very slowly what alcohol does fast. And that is why we have to make sure these things are pure, not for their sake, to hell with them, for my sake. And the concept of the fourth step is, I mean, of the 12th step. I can never get paid for it. I must never get recompensed for it, even directly or indirectly, because of one thing. It'll detract from what it does for me. And a secondary reason, the great sense of 12-step work and sponsorship, of course, is very simple for self-centered people. When I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke, which is like a little vacation in the country, in a sense. But it's a very simple tradition. As I say, I could read it aloud to you, and we could all nod wisely and doze off, but that's what it means. The last tradition I'm going to talk about this morning is another one that's been under some fire, not fire, but has violated a great deal, and the steps dealing with anonymity. Now, the beginning of this step, that was predicated in a real sense on the Washingtonian experience, and then also with the early days of AA. You may or may not know the Washingtonian experience, one of the great problems they had were the terrible battles they had of who got the most notice for their talks and who was the most important, because they'd run stories about their talks in the paper. So-and-so from Baltimore has come to Philadelphia to talk on the Washingtonians. And it was really a terrible competition for acknowledgement. They said it wasn't, but it really was. All of us understand that. Down deep, we all would like to be famous for something good. And so that was one of the things that pulled them apart. Terrible conflict set up in the Washingtonians about publicity and who got the most important. And then also in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, it would seem logical. The trouble is the traditions, they go against what seems logical sometimes till you understand them. The logic would say the more people that you can tell about it, there must be something going on in there. Must be exciting. They all come back with their face flushed. That's just a little joke. I have to take that off the tape, please. There's one thing nice about being a schizophrenic, as I've been classified several times, I could entertain my other personality sometimes. I hear things I've never heard before. Huh. As I like to say, John was talking about the committees this morning and last night, the various committees. That's what I was thinking about when I was committed to this Texas Insane Asylum, unjustly, as a split personality. And I often thought I'd like to go back there someday and find him. He's must be an old, feeble guy, and I could move him around pretty good, you know. And denounce him and say, "You idiot! Calling me a dual personality. What a goofy diagnosis. Christ, if I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it." If I could just get two voices, I'm home free. But, you know, I hear people say, I think I need group therapy. I have never needed group therapy. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's true, right? One of the great breaks AA had was a violation of tradition, of that tradition before the tradition was written. I know most of you know that story about there was a very famous pitcher for the Cleveland Indians named Bob Feller. And most of you have heard of Bob Feller. And his catcher, who really caught him and did the best work for him, who Bob Feller felt most comfortable pitching to, was a man named Raleigh Helmsley, pitching for the Cleveland Indians, 39, 40, 41. And Raleigh Helmsley was a drunk. Got to be a drunken athlete. Like today's athletes get on cocaine, then they got more, perhaps, than alcohol, more obvious. And so he's one of the guys the Cleveland Indians sent him to Dr. Bob to get straightened out in Akron. And he got an AA and stayed sober. And the next year in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, they said, "Raleigh, tell us about it." There's a big picture and a big story. Cleveland catcher gets off booze. And long, glowing quotes from Bob Feller, "Boy, Raleigh's really calling those pitches right now, and everything's wonderful." And it really gave AA a great boost, in a sense. And it would seem logical. Why not publicize it? But then you start to slide back into self-aggrandizement. You start to slide back into competitiveness. You start to slide back into the negation of the spiritual concept of it all. But it's hard to see that because it isn't intellectual. It's an emotional and spiritual deep feeling. Let's look at the long form of the 11th tradition just for a second. It says, "Our relations with the general public should be characterized by personal anonymity. We think AA ought to avoid sensational advertising. Our names and pictures as AA members ought not to be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed." See, it doesn't say radio in there or anything like that. It just says broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. That describes everything. You may wonder why they don't change the traditions to read and TV. Do you know why they don't? I'll tell you a simple reason. Nothing in the traditions can be changed under our charter, I believe this is correct, unless it has the written acceptance of 3/4 of the AA groups in existence. If you want to go out and get that, you know. You just have to take it on spec. Our public relations should be guided by the principle of attraction rather than promotion. There's never need to praise ourselves. We feel it better to let our friends recommend us. And that certainly is true. As Bill has written several times and was shown last night in the pictures, the early friends of AA did much more for AA than we could have done. Another little fringe organization blurbing how wonderful we are and surrounded by the what would be obvious, mostly failures. And as the greatest, probably single impetus to Alcoholics Anonymous history was the Jack Alexander article. And as John mentioned this last night in passing, but it's something to think about again. The guy that wrote it, Jack Alexander, was the Saturday Evening Post expose writer. He had just finished doing an expose on the dock workers, the corruption in the dock workers. And now his next assignment, get them alcoholics. Get them people bleeding, these poor drunken bastards. And he got over there and he was astonished as the days went by. He saw they were just what they said they were. Even more than they said they were. He couldn't believe it. He could not believe it. He's a cynical guy. He wasn't some starry-eyed idealist saying, tell me about your program. He talked to people and he tried to find chinks in the armor and he's, what did you really think?
I don't know, just trying to help my fellow man be of service to God. Yeah.
People who are really basically nice are suspicious to all of us. We were talking last night. I don't want to bring up anybody, but my friend Bill B. over there, known to many of us as just a wonderful, nice man. Not to his pigeons, but to his contemporaries. And they said, isn't he a nice man? And I said, he's too nice. He's got to be doing something secretly we don't know about. Maybe twisting baby chickens' necks. Yeah, just something. Most of us are not taken by niceness. Jack Alexander was more cynical than we are. And he came up, he couldn't believe it. He wrote this article, which changed the course of human history in a sense. We jumped. They started to pour it. The woman I talked about, Sybil, this first woman, who they first wouldn't let in the meeting. Some of you have heard her talk, but she has a fascinating story. I feel kind of stupid because some years ago she decided to make me her sponsor. And I don't give her much advice, I'll tell you, if you don't mind. She's one of some quiet sponsors you have to listen to. That's why she chose me. Anyway, but she talks about going to her first, you know, when this article came out, and inquiries flooded New York from all over the country. And they had a whole armful in the Los Angeles area. And they sent them off to Los Angeles office. So at her second meeting, or her first meeting, that they let her in, the guy called her and said, well, we've separated all the inquiries from women. You're in charge of them, Sybil. She said, I don't even know what you do here. He says, well, you don't have to know. Just tell them that you came here and you bring them to next time. And she got all these women, right? I don't know what goes on, but... And I don't know if they stayed sober, but she did, which is the name of that gate. But, you know, our friends have given us most of the help that we need. Every so often, we run across a rush, and we're doing it again now, of movie actors or celebrities who think they're going to help AA by announcing they're an Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a spiritual reason, which I'll discuss a little bit tomorrow, why that is not correct, really, on them. But, you know, they think they're going to give us any help. We don't need any help like that. If people come to AA only because some goofy stage actor or football player does, or, you know. I know at the Betty Ford Foundation, they try to teach them about AA in between other things. And they know about anonymity, but they come pouring out of there and the first thing, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous! You know, to help their damn career, as far as I can see. Because it's violation. I know several actors in AA, so, you know, Academy Award winners in AA, who when you go to a meeting, you would never in the world know they're an actor. They never break their anonymity. They wash the coffee cups. They act like Alcoholics Anonymous members. I sponsor a guy who's got a TV series, and every time he goes out, we go out to have lunch, people say, oh. You know, but he washes the coffee pots at our meeting. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get these clean, don't I?
Some of you have met him in our group, and he's just a guy sitting there. And sure, he's impressive the first few weeks, but after a while, if you act like an AA member, eventually you'll be treated like an AA member. But if you insist on being treated like a celebrity, eventually it'll cost you a great deal. Because again, you maintain that feeling of difference. But almost every so often now you hear people being, yes, I'm an AA member. Another actor, another. I remember one of the saddest things in 1972, presidential candidate, who was one of our old line great AA members, who maintained his anonymity as a state governor, as a senator, as all sorts of things. Then he got running for the office, and his campaign was faltering. So he let it be known he was an AA member, hoping I'd give him some impetus. As a matter of fact, it didn't do him any good at all, and that was a good thing. I guess a lot of people think, do I want a guy like that with his thumb over the red button? I'm depressed. A guy looked at me funny on the bus. So I think you and I, again, during the number of reasons we can talk about length, but you just want to take it on spec. Not on spec, but on an acceptance. That anonymity is the best help for Alcoholics Anonymous. Certainly the central office, the World Service Office, does little commercials, talks about AA is there. That's the purpose of open meetings, is to share the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get many of our referrals from AA. You know, there are a couple, I was thinking about Hill Street Blues. You know, they showed AA meetings in there. Not real AA meetings, but make-believe AA meetings. And the reason was because a couple of the people on the show were AA members, and they saw that they were right. But nobody in that show ever broke their anonymity. You don't know who the two members are unless you know them. But they had, there's AA groups. I'll tell you a funny little thing. Days of Wine and Roses, which great, great. I don't know if it ever got anybody to AA, but I saw it on Playhouse 90 the week I got sober. Somebody took me to his house to see it. And I remember what impressed me most about that show is that the woman did not get sober. If it had another happy ending, I'd have just written it off. But it really struck me. Geez, the guy's so... And I'd been slipping around AA for 9 years by that time. And what impressed me most is that she didn't get sober, but it's a great thing. There's a guy in our group who directed that Playhouse 90. He's been sober 10 years. But he directed that 33 years ago, 34 years ago. And one of the funny stories he has is that the technical advisor on there was some guy he didn't know named Bill, somebody from New York. He said at the end of the show, he gave me a copy of their damn old book, and he'd written something in it, and I just said, that's great. Thanks a lot. See you around. I haven't worked on a new show. Then he got sober years later today, and he, where's that goddamn book? Well, he searched for that book. But things like those kind of movies and shows, and the movie that was appeared later. There's an AA meeting in there. I think this is apart from the 12th tradition, you know, 11th tradition in a sense. But I just think about that movie, I'm just sharing experience. It's a funny thing how sobriety makes you look different. Most of us know the guy wakes up and he's back in the nut house. in the original story, he's got the DTs and there are big cockroaches crawling on, but they couldn't show it in television, just screaming and coming to you. And this guy played by Jack Klugman in the movie comes to the door and says, "Hi, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. I've come to help you. And if you are like me," I got tears in my eyes because I knew he was going to be all right, in a sense. Now, that's been on sober 5 years. And I thought, God, that's... Oh! And then I had to think, years before that, I sat in that same situation when I was drinking. And the guy came to my door at the Big Spring State Nut House in Texas in the shock ward and said, "I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to talk about your problem?" And my instinctive thought was, how can I use this goofy bastard to get out of here? Is it just, you have no way of knowing. So it isn't a matter, we can, in retrospect, we can say, yes, we did this and we're going to do that. But when you're going through it, it's all complex. And when you're new and don't know how to do it, it's complex. It's terribly strange. When we converted can talk about how the wonderful spiritual values involved. But the ones we're trying to reach are people who don't have those spiritual values. So the anonymity prospect certainly must be maintained. You know, they think, well, I'm going to help AA. But I, of course, I watch movie actors who are going to help AA and 6 months later they're drunk again. And they don't know why. I know why, based on what I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I'm saying in effect is this. All of these traditions really seem rather simple today. It's hard to realize that they were gained after much controversy. And not only that, but they are predicated on thousands and thousands of people like you and me dying doing it differently. That's where they come from. These do not evolve out of... Nobody came down from the mountain and with 12 tablets. "Here are your traditions." Oh, you know. They got them out of watching people die and be sick and desperate and use their intellect to try to fight their way through. And that's why we got to try to observe them whether you agree with them or not. Nobody cares if you agree with them. You have to defend them because your life depends on it. You must maintain a primary purpose of carrying a message to the alcoholic who still suffers. In fact, that's one of the things I didn't mention last night. You know, when the 12 steps were first written in manuscript form, the 12 steps said, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to practice these principles on our affairs and carry this message to other people. And they had to point out, can't help other people. We can help alcoholics. So they changed that before it was printed. The other thing was changed after it was printed. What you must have here is a desire to stop drinking. There's one other little funny thing in there I want to mention. We're almost done. The third tradition is the only tradition that's been changed since it was written, as some of you know. It was written and promulgated as the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Then after they studied that for a while, they realized that's the way it looks to people who are already sober. We want you new people to have an honest desire to stop drinking. But I never heard of anybody who had an honest desire to stop drinking before they stopped drinking. You know, honest desire to get rid of that problem, to get that woman off my back, to get my job back, to get out of this jam! Honest desire is something you get after you're sober. I now want to stop drinking. And so they had to change that, because it turns out any kind of desire to stop drinking, anything to get here, anything to put your butt in those seats, anything to get the value of others talking to you. So, desire to stop drinking, primary purpose to carry that message to alcoholics, to suffers. The moot point, we don't hire people to do 12-step work under any conditions, but other people can do jobs that they get paid for, which are not considered 12-step work. And we maintain anonymity at the level of broadcast and media and films. A lot of people say you can't do that. I say you can. Because of the nature of my work, I'm on television a lot in Los Angeles. Some of you know that. I'm on television a lot. They're always asking me about drunks and alcoholism in the area where I work. And I've had several articles in the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times written about me, and they've article to Reader's Digest and all these things, because this executive went down to work on Skid Row, and it's all very touching and beautiful. But at no time have my anonymity ever been broken. And if you may wonder what anonymity is broken, let me just, I should have said this, then we'll stop. The only question about anonymity today is, what is breaking anonymity? Is it saying, I'm a recovered alcoholic? Nope. I always describe myself as a recovered alcoholic, the Liberal Presbyterian film. It is being identified as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you can go on talk shows, radio talk shows, with your first name or an adopted first name. That does not violate your tradition. You can go on television, they can show your face, but then you can't be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can live, be in shadow, and then you can be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't, in any media, have your either your picture or your full name connected with you as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can be a recovered alcoholic, you can be an ex-problem drinker, you can be anything. Or you can be Jim C., an alcoholic, but you cannot be Clancy Immersland, Alcoholics Anonymous member, ever. And it's an amazing thing that so many people don't understand that. They say, well, your name was in the paper. Sure it's in the paper, I'm a human being. You know, it doesn't mean you drop out of sight. But you can't be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because it would take away from the spiritual cachet, which I'll talk a little bit about tomorrow when I wind up. But anyway, the traditions are really, when you think about them, logical and simple. And you and I must remember to do them, even though the weight of public opinion in our group might wish it otherwise. You and I must stand up for our continued existence. Let us have lunch.